What about the rest of my family? I ventured after a while. I mean, not to sound ungrateful, but didn't I have grandparents? Why didn't they take me? I asked that same question before we signed the papers. For selfish reasons, I confess. I didn't want anyone to show up later and try to claim you back once you were ours. We were told there was no immediate family to take you. Your father's parents were already dead, and your mother's. I gather they were separated and not in particularly good health themselves. Not the ideal home life for a traumatized little girl. So the decision was made to find you a new family. It was quick. They cut through all the red tape. No one wanted to see you stuck in bureaucratic limbo. But didn't they ever try to visit me? My own grandparents? Once. Mom lowered her eyes. Your grandmother wrote once, asking to see you. We thought it was too soon, that seeing her might confuse you. She didn't have any legal rights, not after we finalized the adoption. Mom hesitated. I did write to her, some years after that. The letter was returned unopened. She and your grandfather had both passed away by then. I winced. A minute went by before I could speak again. And why you? Why did I come here? Mom glanced at me sideways. You know, I had trouble delivering Anthony. Yes. I couldn't think how I knew this. It wasn't something I could remember ever being openly discussed. I was unwell for a long time after his birth. We both stayed in the hospital for several weeks. It's all fine now, of course, but the end result was that we couldn't have another child. It was physically impossible for me to carry a baby again. And we so badly wanted a girl. I so badly wanted a girl. She smiled. So we signed up with an adoption agency. We weren't sure it would lead to anything, and for a couple of years it didn't. We knew we were low priority. We already had two healthy children. But it turned out, in your case, that was helpful. It bumped us to the top of the list. The social workers wanted experienced parents, a happy, stable family that you could slot right into. I showed them pictures. How I had a girl's room all done up in pink, just in case. A week later, we got the call. I remembered the pink room. It was a little girl's dream. The centerpiece was a lace canopy bed worthy of Cinderella. Beside it, on the carpet, had stood a matching miniature bed for my favorite doll. My plastic Fisher-Price record player had a real needle to play vinyl 45s, and my light bulb-powered Holly hobby oven had singed a hole in the carpet, burn marks apparently being a signature of my childhood. What I could not summon now, for the life of me, was any memory of seeing that room for the first time. I had never given it much thought, but I suppose I had always assumed that before the canopied bed, a baby's crib had stood there. My crib. That was the logical evolution, just as the canopy bed had given way at some point in my teenage years to the queen-size mattress and headboard that now dominated the room. I had slept in that queen bed last night. The burned carpet had been replaced, the pink walls long since repainted a tasteful shade of taupe. Mom slid into a chair beside me and set two plates on the table. While I was wallowing in nostalgia, she had whipped up an omelet. Bacon, eggs, grated cheese. She knows I love bacon, pork in all forms. I have been known to go well out of my way for good chorizo. But when I took a bite, I spit it right back out. My mother looked mildly offended. I'm sorry. It tastes like cardboard. Ah. She touched my hand. That can happen when you've had a shock. I stared at my plate in surprise. I thought that was just something people said. Or, you know, literary license. Lazy writers always make grieving characters lose their appetite and complain how everything tastes like cardboard. I had no idea it was true. My mouth felt filthy. I crossed to the sink and spat again, scooped cold water and splashed my face over and over, until my hair was matted and water dripped onto the tiled floor. I stood there trembling. My mother rose and rested her hand on my back while I shook. After a long time, I straightened. Why didn't you and Dad tell me? How could we? What happened to you was so awful, more than any child could bear. But what about later, when I was an adult? I'm 37 years old, for God's sake. They advised us not to. The adoption counselors. They said it would confuse you. And Caroline, that's the way it was done back then. Adoptions were nearly always closed. Even children with less dramatic histories never learned who their birth parents were. Lots of children grew up not knowing they were adopted. I pulled away from her. You should have told me. For the first time, she looked impatient. Sweet girl, would it have made you happy? What good would it have done? Later that morning, I taught my Friday class as usual. Fren 388, the novel in 19th century France. It's frowned upon to call in sick, and it turned out to be a relief to pass an hour focused on something I understood, a subject that I had mastered. Today's assignment was Flaubert's Madame Bovary, a book I always look forward to teaching. The portrait of a woman trapped in a dull marriage. It is a groundbreaking work for feminists. It was scandalous back in its day. In 1857, Flaubert was put on trial for obscenity and crimes against public morality. This is because of the disgraceful behavior of his protagonist, Emma Bovary. She lies to her husband and lavishes a cigar case and a silver-handled riding crop on her lover. Still, she has her charms, and I usually take the time with my students to savor her seductions, her little vanities. Today, though, I felt impatient. Her sins felt tame against the revelations of my last 24 hours. Emma Bovary thought she had problems. At least she knew who her parents were, and no one had murdered them, and she wasn't running around with a bullet jammed against her spine. With considerable effort, I managed to stick with my prepared lecture notes. I even ended with a flourish about how provocatively Flaubert had illuminated the turbulent social and political landscape of 1850s France. My students seemed to like this. They all diligently scribbled it down. I rewarded them by ending class a few minutes early. Then I gathered my notes, switched off the lights, and stepped into the quiet hallway. What now? According to my usual Friday routine, I should retire to my fourth floor library nook for an exciting afternoon of grading papers and sipping herbal tea. I pictured my blue armchair, my electric kettle, my I Heart NPR mug, neatly rinsed and left to dry. I couldn't face them. Instead, I headed toward the white Gravener building's wide staircase. Outside, the lawn of the main quad was busy. Students throwing frisbees, calling to friends, making weekend plans. The day was pretty but cool. I began to walk, with no particular direction in mind. I just needed to move. I was near the main university gates and the John Carroll statue when my legs folded. One moment I was walking, and the next I was on the ground. I had eaten nothing since yesterday morning. But this wasn't a faint. Nothing so dainty. I just gave out. The body overriding the brain. Here is something I did not know before, but was about to learn. When a person receives a great shock, that person both continues to function and doesn't. Let me explain. At that moment, I could not stand up. But I was capable of sitting there on the cold sidewalk and registering quite clearly how I must look. My legs splayed, my hair askew, my bag strewn behind me. Some tiny part of me relished the spectacle. Students were cutting me a wide berth. I calculated what they must be thinking, how long it would take before someone bent down to ask if I was all right. What would my answer be? 7. Saturday, October 12th, 2013. It was Saturday morning when the bullet began to throb. Not a steady ache like my wrist. This felt more ragged, more demanding. The pain came and went, but when it was there, it was hot. I imagined the bullet pulsing like an organ. Back when I was a girl, the whole country was caught up in the frenzy for the Star Wars movies. I was a baby when the first one came out, but I do remember weeping on the morning that Return of the Jedi hit the theaters. I must have been 6 or 7 by then. Tony and Martin were allowed to go see it. I was deemed too young and ordered to stay home. It seemed an unbearable injustice. Afterward, my brothers annoyed me for weeks by conversing in garbled Yoda syntax. "Told you I did. The potatoes, please pass." They also joked about sensing a disturbance in the Force. It sounds hokey, but 30 years later, this is the phrase that now came to mind. I did sense something like a disturbance, as though the bullet wielded some force that was disturbing the normal rhythms of my body. I thought about the veins and muscles in my neck, how for years they must have grown and pushed and curved around the lead, like the roots of a tree when they met resistance from a stone. I had been 3 years old when I was shot. 3. That meant the bullet had been inside my body for longer than my teeth. I called my doctor late that afternoon. "Was it possible," I asked him, "that an ancient wound could start hurting just like that?" "Unlikely," he replied, "but describe the pain." I thought about it. "Hot, like it's radiating heat or something?" "Well, it's definitely not doing that, unless it's gotten infected, but I didn't see any sign of that when I examined you this week." "Okay, but it really is throbbing. I can feel the metal, the physical weight of it, like it's jabbing me." "I suspect that might be psychosomatic." "I am not imagining this, Dr. Zartman." "Call me Will. And I'm not suggesting you are. It would be an entirely normal reaction. Now that you know it's there, you're going to feel it. I suppose it's also possible that the bullet has shifted. Perhaps it's pressing on a nerve that it wasn't before."
"Why would it shift?"
"That I don't know."
"And would that be why my wrist started aching?"
A long pause. "I don't know that either. Half the patients I see seem to be suffering from mild cases of carpal tunnel. It's almost always because they spend too much time in front of their keyboards. So that was my natural assumption in your case. But if that bullet is pressing on a nerve, then sure. Symptoms might be presenting in your wrist.
And maybe I really am feeling pain in my neck, too."
He ignored this. "I'll call and hassle the lab again. Try to hurry them up on your blood work. I'd like to see your blood lead level. They work 7 days a week over there. Maybe they'll have something by tomorrow."
"Thank you."
"And I should hear back on Monday from Marshall Gellert, the neurosurgeon. I couldn't track him down yesterday, but he's the best in town. I'll ask him to see you right away."
"And then what?"
"We'll have to see what he says. Meanwhile, what did you find out from your parents? Can they help with figuring out how it got there?"
I made a sound somewhere between a laugh and a bark.
"You were right.
They knew."
"And?"
I laugh barked again. "How much time have you got?" He listened for nearly an hour. After we hung up, I stepped out my front door and went for a long walk through the streets of Georgetown. No collapses this time, just the steady beat of my boots hitting brick. And in my neck, the dark mass of the bullet, throbbing, pulsing, keeping time. The Tombs is a Georgetown institution, a big, dark brick cellar one block from campus. There is a bar on one end and a noisy restaurant packed with undergrads on the other. It's the kind of place where students meet their roommates for happy hour pitchers and buffalo wings on a Saturday night, then return hungover the next morning to meet their parents for an Eggs Benedict brunch. It's tradition to come to the door at midnight on your 21st birthday. They stamp you on the head and pour your first legal beer on the house. I did think twice about turning up on Saturday night. I might bump into someone I knew from the university, and I wasn't in the mood for chit-chat. But the thought of staying home was too depressing. Plus, the Tombs is right around the corner from me, and I couldn't be bothered dressing up and heading anywhere swanky. So I called Martin and told him to meet me. We settled ourselves in a leather booth in the back corner and sat staring at each other. Martin knows me too well to bother with small talk. Instead, he flagged down a waiter, ordered the artichoke dip and a beer for himself, and a glass of white wine for me. It is not quite true what I said earlier about not liking whiskey. I like rye whiskey fine. I can't stand scotch. But a few years back, I was seeing a man from Kentucky. He liked to drink Sazeracs, mixed with rye from a distillery near where he grew up. Rye tastes like bourbon, but better. More peppery and less sweet. I acquired the taste and still drink it on the rare occasion when I am drinking to get drunk. Martin knows this. He raised an eyebrow when I canceled the wine and requested instead a double bullet, neat. All he said, though, was, "Make it two." We sipped in silence for a bit. Then he said, "Irritating, isn't it? How it's become all fashionable lately."
"What?"
"Rye."
"It's fashionable?"
"Don't you ever go out? It's the hip thing. Laura and I actually got invited to a rye tasting the other night. All these 40-somethings who never drink anything but $75 a bottle Bordeaux, sipping and pretending to detect notes of green apple and tobacco."
"I just like the taste."
"See, that's the fashionable thing to say. Very authentic of you."
He took another sip, then looked into my eyes.
"You used to have nightmares when you first came. You would crawl into my bed and curl up against me, hot and all wet with tears. When I woke up in the morning, you were always gone. Do you remember?"
"God, I'm getting sick of people asking me that." He looked hurt. "I'm sorry, Martin. I'm sorry. But you know, you're one of the worst parts of all this." I pointed at him. "You and me. Finding out that you're not really my brother."
"I am really your brother."
"You know what I mean."
"You mean we aren't related by blood?"
I nodded.
"I thought about that, too."
He glanced around, then picked up a steak knife lying on the table. He held out his finger and drew the serrated blade across it. Drops of blood sprang out.
He reached across the table. "Your turn."
I must have looked aghast.
"Come on, trust me. Give me your hand."
I did as he said. The blade hurt more than you would think as it sank into my flesh. He set down the knife and pressed his finger against mine.
"Now I am your blood brother."
For the first time since this all began, I started to cry. I knew it was only a gesture, but at that moment it felt like the kindest thing anyone had ever done for me. We sat there, hands clasped, tears running down my face. He wrapped a napkin around our fingers and held it tight. "Martin, I didn't mean..."
"Shush. You don't have to say anything." He caught our waiter's eye and mouthed, "Two more." The waiter looked at me with misgiving, no doubt thinking I was enough of a mess as it was, but he trotted off. The drinks went down easy. We were on our third round when suddenly I grinned.
"What?" asked Martin.
"We're drinking bullet."
"So?"
"Pronounced bullet, and I've got a bullet in my neck."
"Not funny."
"Oh, come on. It's hilarious." I clinked my glass against his. Slowly, he smiled.
"Technically, you know, we're drinking shots of bullet. Get it? Bullet shots?"
"Okay, that was lame," I said, but I started to laugh. We were both laughing and laughing, and it was around that time that the room began to spin. At some point, Martin must have paid and bundled me up the tomb's steep stairs and out onto 36th Street, and then home and into my own bed. Brothers are good for things like that. 8. Sunday, October 13th, 2013. If you have ever been run down and flattened by a bus, then you have some idea how I felt the next morning. I doubt I would have crawled out of bed at all if the phone hadn't rung.
"Did I wake you?" asked Will Zartman.
No, I was just... Actually, yes.
"What time is it?"
"Coming up to 11 o'clock.
Christ, right. I guess I had a big night last night.
"Oh, out at a party?"
"Just a bar." I groaned. I think I drank half my body weight in rye.
"Very trendy."
"So I'm told."
"I'd rather never see this stuff again." "Hair of the dog," he said.
"Sorry?"
"Go fix yourself a Bloody Mary. You'll feel better. Only hangover cure I've ever tried that works. Mind you, that's just me talking. As your doctor, I suggest you make a pot of coffee and go back to bed. And, of course, never, ever consume more than 4 units of alcohol in a single session again."
"Right."
"So who were you out with?" he asked casually. "Some girlfriends?"
Was I imagining it? Or was something more than purely medical solicitousness in his voice? "My brother."
"Oh, fun."
He also must have sensed he'd crossed a line because he cleared his throat and adopted a more clinical tone.
"Anyway, sorry to have disturbed you on a Sunday morning, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I got your results from the lab this morning. Nothing we need to be majorly alarmed about at this point, but your blood lead level is quite high."
"How high?"
29. That's micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. For adults, anything over 25 is considered elevated. That's when people start showing symptoms. Headache, irritability, delayed reaction time, that type of thing.
"Great," I said miserably. "I needed something else to worry about."
"Of course, it could be completely unrelated. Where do you live?"
"Georgetown."
"Ah, old house?"
1859. Georgetown is a historic district.
Almost all the houses are 100 years old or more. Well, there you go. You could have lead paint on the walls, or lead pipes. Do you drink DC tap water?
"Every day."
"Ghastly stuff. Swimming with critters you don't even want to imagine. And of course, for years it was contaminated with dangerous levels of lead. But listen, put this out of your mind for now. We'll cross that bridge when we have to. It's just one more factor in the mix."
"In what mix?"
"In the mix as we make a decision on whether to schedule surgery to try to get that bullet out."
A Google search turned up little. I had finally dragged myself out of bed and brewed a pot of tea. Then I settled myself with my laptop on the living room sofa and tried to ferret out any information I could find about Sadie Rawson and Boone Smith. It was strange. These days, even the dullest person would generate a dozen search hits, if only from friends tagging him in photos. But my birth parents had died 15 years before the internet became widespread. You couldn't Google them. The main newspaper in Atlanta, the Journal Constitution, must have reported on the murders. Crime was worse back then in big American cities, but surely a double homicide and the near-fatal wounding of a child would have drawn media attention. But the Journal Constitution's online archives were only digitized back to 1990. Everything older was presumably on microfiche, gathering dust somewhere. The only hit I got was for a class of 1974 in memoriam list on the website for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It had been updated this past spring, in advance of a 40th reunion gathering planned for next year. The list was titled, In Memory of Those Classmates Who Have Passed Away Since Graduation, and included dozens of names. Both Boone and Sadie Rawson were on it. There was no other information, not even the date of their deaths. That was it. No wedding announcement, no work-related press releases, no photographs. I pulled out the birth certificate that my mother, Franny, had fetched from the upstairs files for me. It stated that I had been delivered at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta. The home address it gave for Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith was Eulalia Road, in the northeast of the city. I plugged that into Google Maps and selected the street view option. A minute later, I was staring at their old house. Eulalia Road appeared to be a short, quiet, residential street. My first home had been in the middle of the block, a one-story brick house with a separate detached garage farther up the driveway. The grass lawn in front had a big tree, which blocked my view of the front door itself. But you could see that the house was well kept, the brick and shutters freshly painted. I had no way of knowing if this was the house in which my birth mother and father died. They were murdered 3 years after they had brought me home from the hospital. They might have moved. Still, I couldn't stop staring. The zoom function was frustratingly blurry. The picture wasn't sharp enough to let me see in the windows. Yes, I knew the interior would have been redecorated. The owners might have changed many times since 1979. No trace of me or of my first family would remain in that pretty little house. But all day long, I kept wandering back to my laptop, hitting refresh on the image, and imagining a small girl turning somersaults on that lawn. I am not known for rash decisions. I tend to drive my friends crazy, thinking and rethinking choices for weeks before finally staking out a course of action. It's the way I'm hardwired, the way I move physically as well. Slowly, methodically, like a dancer moving through deep water. I think this is why in my work I'm drawn to the literature of centuries past. I like that Marcel Proust spends 30 pages describing how his character tosses and turns in bed before falling asleep. And that's the action-packed part of his masterpiece, In Search of Lost Time. Proust meanders for a further 6 volumes before wrapping things up. It's a gorgeous book. By comparison, contemporary literature feels too frenetic. Suffice to say, I am not a taker of spur-of-the-moment trips. But that evening, my thoughts kept circling back to the house in Atlanta. I wondered what color the shutters had been painted when my birth parents lived there. I wondered how tall the tree out front had stood, what kind of car they had parked in the garage. I wanted to see it. I wanted to go there, see the house, and find whatever remained of my first life. It felt urgent. The more I thought about it, the more certain I was that I would be too distracted to go through the motions of my normal routine tomorrow. I never miss work. I couldn't remember taking a sick day in all the years I'd worked at the university. But surely this counted as a personal emergency? And I actually was unwell, I thought, touching my neck. It would be tricky. Fall semester was in full swing. I had 4 lectures to teach in the week ahead. But the next break in the academic calendar wasn't until Thanksgiving, the end of next month. I would go crazy if I waited that long. I thought for a while, rubbing circles up and down my wrist. Then I checked the clock. 9 p.m., not yet too late to call, and looked up the phone number for Madame Aubuchon. Hélène Aubuchon is the formidable head of Georgetown's French department. She is in her 70s, but her posture, not to mention her legs, put students 4 decades younger to shame. The French use an acronym, CPCH, to describe a certain type of aristocratic woman. It stands for Collier de Perle, Carré Hermès, meaning a lady too well-bred to leave the house without her pearl necklace and Hermès scarf. Hélène must have perfected the look in Paris back in the 1960s, and she'd remained immaculately pulled together ever since. I respected her, and I was also a little afraid of her. She answered on the 4th ring.
Allô? Bonsoir, Madame Aubuchon. Je suis désolée de vous déranger.
We had worked together for years now, but I still addressed her with the formal vous. Hélène Aubuchon, in my experience, was not prone to informality.
I'm so sorry to bother you at home, I continued in rapid French, but I've had a bit of a family emergency. I'm going to need to take a few days off.
Ah? When were you thinking?
Well, ideally, starting tomorrow.
Non, tout à fait impossible, she said sternly. But you know this, not in the middle of the term.
I've just found out I was adopted when I was very young. I never knew.
Oh la la, ma chère, that must have been a shock. However, I need you to run the study abroad session on Wednesday evening, and you are needed in the classroom, that sophomore tutorial sortu.
The reason I was adopted is that my mother and father were murdered.
Silence.
And may I tell you how I learned all this? It's because doctors discovered a bullet in my neck, right up against my spine. It was fired there by whoever murdered my parents. They shot me, too.
More silence. Then,
mais je ne comprends pas.
I don't understand.
A bullet?
Yes, in my neck.
But you don't mean it's still there?
It is. I can send you the x-ray if you like. The bullet glows bright white.
And your parents were... You said they were murdered.
My birth parents, yes.
She let out a little poof of air.
Oh la 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 la.
I imagined her loosening the Hermès and fanning herself.
Je m'excuse. Take as much time as you need.
A quick check online revealed that flights departed Reagan National Airport for Atlanta nearly every hour tomorrow. They weren't prohibitively expensive, either. I picked a mid-morning departure, Delta Flight 1139. Then I opened a small suitcase and began tossing in sweaters, leggings, a caramel-colored suede skirt.
What did one pack for such a trip?
What passed for an appropriate wardrobe for an outing to lay flowers on the graves of a mother and father you had never known? When I had booked my plane ticket, the computer asked whether I was traveling for business or pleasure. Neither. Not even remotely. I jotted down a list of everyone I should remember to tell that I was leaving town. My family, obviously. A student for whom I'd agreed to serve as thesis advisor. Also, Will Zartman. His name gave me pause. I was supposed to go see his neurosurgeon colleague next week. I reached up and touched my neck. The pain was less intense today. Will was probably right. I was only imagining I could feel something. The neurosurgery consult could wait.
The bullet had been in my neck for 34 years. Another few days wouldn't hurt.
It occurred to me that there must be knock-on effects from this week's surreal developments that haven't even dawned on me yet. Yesterday, for example, after hanging up with Will, I reflected that all my life, I had blithely filled in medical forms claiming no family history of diabetes or heart disease. Whereas, for all I knew, all four of my biological grandparents had dropped dead from massive coronaries. I had no clue what my family medical history was. I felt a stab of fury toward my parents, my adoptive parents, if that was the right term. By what right had they kept so much from me? How could they have thought I would not want to know? What made it worse was that I was closer to my parents than to anyone else in the world. They could both read me like a book. I had assumed the reverse was true as well. Now I felt a shift, a fracturing, the decoupling of souls. You think you know people when you grow up with them? When you believe they've been beside you your whole life, you know their voices, the curves of their hands, what makes them laugh. You know their hearts. But it turns out you don't know their thoughts. Not truly. Not in full. All people have their secrets, and not just things they keep from you, but secrets about you, things they hope you'll never learn. You can share your home with someone, share all the silly little details of life, share the soap, the sugar bowl, shoes, and you would never guess. You think you know someone. Then, at the age of 37, you grow up. 9. Monday, October 14th, 2013. I woke up hungry, which, considering I hadn't eaten in 4 days, seemed a good sign. My favorite breakfast is a ham and cheese croissant from Patisserie Poupon on Wisconsin Avenue. This pleasant spot is cramped but sunny, and the only place in Washington that produces croissants and baguettes that taste remotely the way they do in Paris. They also bake a bacon quiche that, trust me on this, will change your life. Amazing what a pastry chef unafraid to embrace obscene quantities of butter, salt, and pork can achieve. I suspect the same formula is at work in the croissant jambon fromage, which is why, for the sake of my thighs, I try to limit myself to stopping by no more than twice a week. Patisserie Poupon is only a few minutes' walk from my house. I could head there for a croissant and tea, swing back home for my suitcase, and still make it to the airport in plenty of time. When I got there, though, I was greeted with a locked door and a closed on Mondays sign. No, no, no. I always forgot this inconvenient detail. I pressed my nose against the glass and squinted, desperate enough to beg an off-duty employee to open up and sell me yesterday's remnants. But the bakery was deserted, swept clean, chairs neatly stacked on tables, sunlight glinting off empty display cases. Not a croissant in sight. Discouraged, I retraced my steps home. I would have to settle for a gluey bagel at the airport. More taste of cardboard. Although, wasn't there a cafe that sold decent prosciutto paninis right after the security line? Which terminal was that again? I was trying to recall as I rounded the corner onto my block and spotted a man standing on my front step. I stopped in my tracks. It was Will Zartman, my doctor, leaning on my doorbell and looking agitated. "Dr. Zartman, is that you? What on earth are you doing here?" I glanced at my watch. It was not yet 9 o'clock. "Caroline, hi. Hi there. I told you, call me Will." He heaved a deep breath. "I thought I'd missed you."
"You did, nearly. I'm just grabbing my bag, but why are you..."
"I got your message when I woke up. I've been trying to call. I must have tried you 5 times. Don't you ever answer your phone?"
I considered this. I'd left my cell phone in the house, propped on top of my suitcase. I often wander out without it, not out of forgetfulness, but because I spend too much time around teenage students who can't conduct a 5-minute face-to-face conversation without twitching for their phones. I like my friends as much as the next person, but I don't feel the need to tweet them my thoughts a dozen times a day. And anyone who needs to reach me can probably wait an hour or two. I don't have the kind of job that demands urgent responses. So, no. On an early walk for my morning croissant, I don't ever answer my phone.
Why are you here? Is something wrong?
Is something wrong? You mean aside from your experiencing a burning sensation in your neck and the fact that an X-ray just confirmed there's a bullet in there? I thought we'd agreed that you would see Marshall this week, the surgeon. You need to talk to him.
I will, as soon as I get back. I just need a couple of days.
No, leaving town is a bad idea. That's why I kept calling. You shouldn't be traveling. I'm worried that you...
But why are you worried? A week ago, you barely knew who I was, and now here you...
I knew who you were. Any man under the age of 90 and still in full possession of his faculties would notice who you were.
I raised my eyebrows. To my surprise, he did not blush or back down. Instead, he leaned forward and gripped my right wrist.
Look, you need to take this seriously. A bullet rubbing against your spine is not something to mess around with.
He turned my arm over, studied it.
You're not wearing your wrist guard.
It's been feeling better.
No, I'll bet it hasn't.
Oh my God, I know whether my own wrist hurts. And anyway, whether it hurts or not is none of your...
I clamped my mouth shut. Whether my wrist hurt was, of course, precisely his business.
I'm going to be late, I said, changing tack. I promise I'll go see your friend Marshall, later this week if you like. Now, excuse me.
I unlocked the door, plucked my phone and suitcase from the front hall, and pulled the door shut again. Will was still standing there. How are you getting to the airport?
Taxi. I'll get one on M Street.
You'll be lucky to catch one in rush hour.
He pulled out his phone, glanced at the time.
My first patient isn't booked until 10. My car's right here. I'll drive you.
Across the river? To National Airport?
It wasn't far, maybe 20 minutes drive.
Still, I'll be fine.
For God's sake, get in the car.
So I did.
He was right. Traffic was terrible. We inched along in silence. An accident had narrowed Memorial Bridge down to one lane for cars crossing into Virginia. Beneath us, the river flowed sullenly, the water choppy and brown. Will's Jeep had a baseball glove and tennis rackets thrown in the back. The radio was tuned to NPR. We listened as the morning edition anchors delivered gloomy updates on the latest horrors in Mali, in Syria, on Capitol Hill. Strangely, my mood lifted as they forged on. So many people in the world had worse problems than I did. By the time the newscasters introduced a story about an oil spill and the resulting environmental catastrophe off the coast of Norway, I broke into a grin. Will glanced over. Oil spills are funny.
No, but honestly, are you listening to this?
I shook my head. If we don't all die from toxic oil fumes, we'll be overwhelmed by rising Islamist militants from the Middle East.
There's no hope.
He grinned too. I was only playing NPR to impress you. Want music instead?
Sure. Whatever you like to listen to is fine.
He hesitated. Country, actually. You probably think it's corny. But yeah, I love it. Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, all the old honky-tonk stuff. Garth Brooks isn't bad.
No. Seriously? Garth Brooks?
Well, but mostly I listen to C-SPAN radio, obviously.
Unlike you, I find there's nothing like live coverage of a House Agriculture Subcommittee to get a guy going in the morning.
I smiled. We fell quiet again, but the silence was more amiable now. I studied his hands on the steering wheel. No wedding ring. Will Zartman was not my type. I tend to go for undernourished, slightly tragic-looking academics. You know the sort, pale, artsy guys who chain smoke while wearing skinny jeans and black turtlenecks. It's a pathology, I know. Too much time spent studying abroad in Paris during my formative romantic years. My penchant for the Euro look has provided endless amusement for my brothers over the years. They excuse themselves to the kitchen and break out in the sprockets routine from Saturday Night Live whenever I bring a new boyfriend home. Tony, in particular, has perfected Mike Myers' mincing hip wriggle.
Now is the time that we dance.
Annoyingly, I had the feeling that Tony and Martin would like Will. He looked both robustly healthy and robustly American. He was into country music, of all things. Definitely not my type. Will pulled up to the curb at airport departures exactly 52 minutes before my flight was scheduled to take off. I didn't have luggage to check. I should just make it. Thanks for the ride. It was awfully nice of you. I reached for the car door. He saw me flinch as I jerked at the handle with my right hand.
Hang on.
He put the car in park, jumped out, ran around, and opened my door from the outside.
Door-to-door service. There you go.
I felt simultaneously charmed and irritated. Okay, well, thanks again.
I'm going to make that appointment for you with Marshall Gellert. How about the end of this week?
Fine.
But will you be back here by then?
He searched my face. I nodded. By Wednesday or Thursday, I would think. I need a few days down in Atlanta to try to make peace with things, and to see their old house and whatever else is left to see, which I'm guessing isn't much.
Right. But Caroline, if that bullet is pressing down on a nerve, and if that's what has inflamed your wrist, then you really need to get it checked before there's any further damage. Promise.
Cross my heart. Then, before I quite understood what was happening, he stepped close. I smelled soap and coffee and something else, an animal scent, as though he'd recently been in the company of a warm dog. He lifted a lock of my hair. His fingers slid down the dark curl, then closed around it and held still for a moment. My breath caught. The gesture was astonishingly intimate. He dropped the curl lightly on my shoulder and stepped back.
Be careful. Take care of yourself.
I will. I couldn't think what else to say, so I turned and walked toward the bright lights of the terminal. Glass doors slid open and then sealed shut behind me. I did not look back. And for 2 days, I did not again think of Will Zartman. Part 2. Atlanta. 10. I wish that I could report a dramatic development the first time I stood outside that house on Eulalia Road. It was early afternoon on Monday when I pulled my rental car up to the curb. The front of the house was in shadow, and the street was quiet. Either few children lived on this block or else they were not yet home from school. Wind rustled the leaves of the graceful elm tree that dominated the front yard. How old must that tree be? 50 years old? 75? It was stout enough that it must already have been well established when the Smiths lived here. I must have played under these branches, must have tried to wrap chubby little arms around this trunk. I waited for an epiphany, for some ancient shard of memory to dislodge itself and come rushing back to me. But no, it was just a tree. The house was just a house. I felt nothing.
I crossed the lawn, climbed 5 brick steps to the front porch, and knocked. No answer. I knocked again and was about to conclude the house was empty when the door cracked open.
Yes?
An older woman's voice. I could see a patch of gray hair above the safety chain, which remained fastened.
Hello. Forgive me for disturbing you. My name's Caroline Cashin, and I used to live in this house when I was a child.
Silence. I fished in my handbag and produced my business card, embossed with the university seal and indicating my status as a member of the faculty. I'd found that pulling rank as a professor could prove useful. Even in Washington, where the average government intern probably wields more actual power than I do, the title commands respect. It's as if people hear professor and are transported back to their student days, a period in their lives when teachers represented ultimate authority. Sure enough, the chain dropped and the door swung open. Inside, the scrawny, nervous-looking woman introduced herself as Nan Dorminey. She loved the house, she told me. Great morning light. She'd bought it 9 years ago when her husband left her. He was a good man, she insisted, misinterpreting my startled look. I shouldn't think otherwise. He just needed his space. I nodded politely. Were Southerners always this forthcoming around strangers? Men can be like that, I offered, hoping this was an appropriate response. Apparently it was, because Nan Dorminey clasped her hands together as though a point of disagreement had been settled. Now then, she asked, when exactly had I lived here, and what could she help me with?
34 years ago, I told her.
Oh, I've no idea who was living here then.
My parents were the Smiths, Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith.
I watched for a sign that she recognized the name. Surely it would have been notorious for a while in this neighborhood. But she shook her head. I tried again. It's a terrible story, but they died in this house, I think. They were killed. Back in the 70s.
Her chin jerked up.
Oh, yes. Old Mrs. Carter told me something about that. Years ago, when I moved in, there was a whole nice family that died. A little girl, too. But the property's changed hands several times since then.
No, that's just it. The little girl was me. I was injured when they died, but I survived. I moved away.
Good heavens.
Her hand fluttered to her heart. We stood without speaking for a moment. Then I asked, this Mrs. Carter you mentioned, is she a neighbor? Did it sound like she knew my parents?
She might have, but I'm afraid she's dead now, too. She passed away last summer, or was it 2 summers ago? Her niece got the house.
Mrs. Dorminey frowned.
I can't think of anyone on Eulalia who goes back that far. 34 years. A long time.
She agreed to show me around in case anything jogged my memory. But she was right. 34 years is a long time. The house had been renovated. She pointed proudly to where previous owners had blown out the back to build an eat-in kitchen, and how she herself had knocked 2 bedrooms together to make space for a master bath. The old pantry had been converted to a laundry room. None of the internal walls were where they used to be. There was only one moment when I asked what lay behind a door off the main hallway.
Oh, that's just the attic, she sniffed. Hot as Hades up there in the summertime.
She opened the door to reveal a dark staircase leading up. The steps were worn wood, stacked with paint cans piled 3 and 4 high. An assortment of dried-out paintbrushes and mixing pans clogged the remaining surfaces. She appeared to use the staircase as shelving, storage for tools for half-forgotten home improvement projects. But something about the slant of the stairs and the sharp smell of dust and unfinished wood tugged at me. I closed my eyes and breathed in. Something flickered. It felt as if there should be a light switch on the left. Not a modern flip switch, but the old-fashioned kind. A metal chain you have to yank. When I peered into the dim opening, there it was. But Mrs. Dorminey was already pulling me back.
"It's been cleared out up there, if that's what you're wondering," she said, not unkindly. "It's only my old clothes up there now. I'm not the kind of person who would move into a house filled with other people's things."
She shut the door, and the moment passed. Afterward, I sat in the rental car, staring at the elm tree. It was still just a tree, just bark and branches, no epiphanies hiding there. Faulkner's famous line came to me. "The past is never dead. It's not even past." William Faulkner would know. Southern writers feel the weight of the past more heavily, capture it more precisely than those from anywhere else. Not even Proust, not even Joyce can touch them. In this case, though, Faulkner had missed the mark. The past was past. Whatever love or laughter or fear or sorrow I had known in that house remained lost to me. The girl who had once climbed those attic stairs was a ghost. Nothing but a ghost. 11. Tuesday, October 15th, 2013. My appointment at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was both productive and painful. I had reasoned that the newspaper might be a source of names. The coverage back in 1979 must have quoted people who knew the Smiths, friends of the family and that type of thing. I had the vague sense that if I could find someone who had once looked my parents in the eyes, who could share a few old stories about them, it would provide me some sense of closure. If that failed, at least the archives might contain details that would help fill in my sketchy understanding of how, not to mention why, my birth parents had died. But as I've mentioned, the paper's website only went back to 1990. So yesterday, after leaving Eulalia Road, I had called the main number. The newspaper proved impenetrable in that hostile way unique to bureaucracies that are allegedly eager to interact with their readers and community. I was disconnected twice and transferred to voicemail more times than I can count, before I finally found myself speaking to one Jessica Yeo. Initially, she was also unhelpful. Any request for articles from the 1970s would take some time, Jessica informed me. The best thing would be to email my specific query to customerquestions@ajc.com. Someone would get back to me. Given my recent attempt to navigate the switchboard, I doubted that. I tried to clarify that my query involved a private matter that might better be explained in person. She sounded even less interested. All kinds of kooks must call the newsroom, claiming hot news tips they needed to pass on in person. "Look," I said finally, when I sensed she was about to hang up on me, "I'm only in town for a day or two. If it matters, I'm calling from Georgetown University. I'm on faculty there and..."
"Your faculty at Georgetown?"
"Yes, it's Professor Caroline Cashin." Ah, the old professorial passe-partout. It worked like a charm. She sighed and allowed that she might have a few minutes if I could swing by the next day, first thing. So this morning at 9, I had pulled up outside the black glass box of a building that housed the Journal Constitution. Surprisingly, the newspaper was not downtown, but in the suburbs, set deep in one of those bland office park mazes that are ubiquitous these days across America. Only one small, easy-to-miss sign identified the headquarters of Atlanta's venerable newspaper. For a moment, I wondered whether I'd come to a satellite office, perhaps where the printing presses or the sales team resided, rather than the news hub. I checked the address. Perimeter Center Parkway. This was definitely it. When she appeared in the lobby, Jessica Yao looked nothing like I'd expected. I had expected the newspaper librarian to look more, well, more like a librarian. Sensible shoes, reading glasses hanging from a neck chain, maybe a prairie skirt. But Jessica Yao might have just stepped out of a boho coffee shop in Berkeley. She was young and wore a floaty, flowered hippie dress utterly ill-suited to the autumn weather outside. This was accessorized by blue nail polish, nose and eyebrow piercings, and a wild cloud of frizzy dark hair. From the way she eyed me, I guessed I didn't fit her image of an academic either. I was wearing a black leather dress over leggings and stiletto boots. The black matched my mood. The boots lent me confidence. And again, if there was such a thing as an appropriate wardrobe for this project, I was damned if I could figure it out. We sized each other up and shook hands. Then she led me across the lobby. She was not, in fact, a librarian, but a research assistant for the news department. This meant helping reporters check facts, find sources, and track down phone numbers. She walked fast, her cowboy boots clacking over the tiled floor, explaining over her shoulder that she only had a few minutes. Things would get busy after the 9:30 a.m. editorial meeting. At the end of a hallway, she waved her ID badge at a scanner, and a door clicked open. We stepped into an ugly beige room stacked floor to ceiling with newspapers and mismatched filing cabinets. "The archives room, such as it is," said Jessica. "So, what dates are we talking?" "Fall of 1979. October or November, I think. The names to search would be for Boone Smith and his wife, Sadie Rawson." Smith is too common a name. There'll be a zillion stories. But we might get somewhere with Boone and, what was the other name? Rawson?" "That's right. Sadie Rawson." "And it's just one article you're trying to find?" "I don't know, actually. I'm hoping there might be several. They might be spread out over a few weeks." She sighed and turned toward a shelf stuffed with large navy cloth-bound books. Near the far end were two labeled 1979. The spines were held together by scotch tape. "Our incredibly high-tech index," she sniffed, yanking out a swivel chair with caster wheels and plopping down. "Theoretically, everybody mentioned in the newspaper should be in here. Theoretically, mind you." She began flipping through yellowed pages. They looked as though they'd been produced on a typewriter. The letters had faded to reddish brown. Jessica was right. There were a zillion entries for Smith. But toward the bottom of the list, under Smith, Sadie Rawson, and Boone, there was a date. Actually, four dates, along with notations of which pages and sections the articles had run in. The first had appeared on November 7th, 1979.
"Bingo!" crowed Jessica. "Alrighty then, let's see what we've got."
She began riffling through drawers.